What is going on, everybody? Welcome to A Theology of Hustle. I'm your host, Curry Blanford, and today I'm talking to Alan Noble. So Alan is Associate Professor of English at Oklahoma Baptist University and the Editor-in-Chief of Christ and Pop Culture. And he comes on today to talk about his book coming out shortly here called You Are Not Your Own. And this book is such a paradigm shift for a lot of the ways that our culture works. In this book, we talk about belonging and how meaning is made in our lives today. We talk about how our culture isn't really built for how we are intended to live as humans, as far as the autonomy goes and just how our lives are set up. And Alan just really has his fingers on the pulse of a lot of like really interesting things going on in our culture and a lot of things that Christians need to be critiquing and pushing back against in our culture. And so you're going to get a ton out of this episode. It's super interesting. We talk about belonging, identity in Christ, and all that. We also talk about a little rap career that Alan had back in the day, as well as so many other great topics. This is just a really fun interview. I think you're going to get a lot out of it. Before we get to the interview, I just want to remind you to make sure you're following me on Instagram and Facebook at A Theology of Hustle. And on Twitter at Curry Blanford, just to stay up to date with all the things we got going on. And I hope you enjoy hearing from Alan. All right. Well, Alan, thanks so much for making time for me and coming on the podcast. I'm excited to chat a little bit.
I'm excited to be here as well.
I love it. It's good stuff. Let's get started and just have you kind of do the quick intro.
Okay. So you want me to talk about me?
Yeah, talk about you. That'd be great.
Talk about me. Where should I start? So I was born in Southern California, homeschooled all my life, except for the part when I finished homeschooling. So I like to say I was a 100%er, which means K through 12, and we had goats. So if you're homeschooled and you didn't have goats, I don't count you as 100%er. You're like you're almost there, but not quite legit. From there, I went to community college, and around that time, I was introduced to Francis Schaeffer and the idea that, you know, the church should be concerned about culture and that we can take culture seriously. Prior to that, I'd been in a lot of fundamentalist churches in one way or another, one strand of fundamentalism or another. And Schaeffer kind of blew my mind because here was someone who's taking secular art of all kinds seriously. And that really piqued my interest and started a passion for me in thinking about how the church should participate, I like to say participate in culture in a way that glorifies God and edifies other people. And so I started studying English. I started studying literature at the community college and then went to Cal State Bakersfield because they had a satellite campus on the community college, and no one in my family had gone to college yet, so I had no idea about like looking for schools. So I was just like, I'll go there because they're here on this campus. So that was easy. And then they had a master's degree in English, and I was like, I guess I'll just keep doing this. I don't know what I'm supposed to do with life. And at that point, I got a grad school mentor who was like, you should apply to grad school, like look at schools. And so my wife and I moved to Waco, and we went to Baylor University. I got a PhD in literature, wrote a dissertation on modern and contemporary literature. And during that time, I was also editing and writing for Christ and Pop Culture, a site that's still up. I mostly do advisory things for it at this point, but it's a great site. And yeah, so I landed at Oklahoma Baptist University. That's where I'm at now. And I teach literature and mentor students, I hope, and write articles and books when I can. And I guess that's my story.
I love it. There was one question I wanted to ask, cause like all that's cool, but what about the hip hop albums? Cause I feel like I need to hear about that.
So as I said, I was really interested in culture, and, I really loved music. I still really love music. And, I played in a band that was not very good, but that's actually where my wife and I met, at community college, playing in a band. She auditioned to play bass for our band, and so we played together and later got married. And I learned to play guitar to meet girls, and so it worked. So now I've never picked up a guitar after we got married. I was like, oh, that's done. That was a waste.
I'm good.
No need to waste time on this anymore. But, you know, I had some friends in Southern California who were into underground hip hop, and they got me into it, and I started recording them, and occasionally I would produce tracks for them. And then I was like, one day, this is such an awkward conversation if you're newly married. I come home from hanging out with one of these friends, and I say to my wife, honey, I think I want to start rapping. and she's like, okay. But it felt like this, like, I need to get this off my chest. This is kind of a big deal. Like, am I ready? I'm, you know, announcing myself, you know, sharing this inner thing, you know, that I'd been freestyling in the car to beats for a while. And now I'm ready to come out to my wife and explain, you know, secretly I want to be a rapper. And she's like, all right, whatever. And so that was really awkward for me. One of the most awkward moments. And so then I recorded two hip hop albums, produced and recorded and performed on two hip hop albums. And then I had to move to Baylor to start grad school. So moved away from the community that was doing that. So that kind of died out.
That's cool. I was/still am like really into it, like underground hip hop, especially.
Okay.
So like that, I'd always... is cool. Once you have kids though, like the hip hop game has to really change quite a bit. You know, you can't really listen to most anything. So
most anything. I was just exercising this morning downstairs and I was like, do you know Galapagos 4, the Chicago group?
Yes.
Okay. So yeah. I love Quell. I've got this Quell mix in my on my phone, and I was like, this is great. I want to put this on. And I was like, no, three little kids. And I guess I'll not do that. Yeah. Yeah. I think I opened for Quell once.
For real? So what was the rap? What was the group called?
It was called Sober Minded.
Okay.
And so everyone assumed that we were like recovering alcoholics, which we weren't. Yeah, you know. So but it was like, it's an idea from the Bible, which didn't, but, we did some fun shows. Yeah. Opening for Quell was great.
That's cool.
It was good.
That's cool. It's nice that Christian hip hop's come a long way from like when I started listening, you know, back in the day. So yeah, it's good.
It was painful. I just wouldn't, but now I'm like, okay,
yeah,
this is good stuff. Yeah. All right.
Yeah, I'm with you.
All right.
Okay. Well, let's get into
the book. You read the book.
Let's get into the book because and I really try to read all the books because I want to have an intelligent conversation about this stuff. You know,
I appreciate that.
It's awkward when you haven't. So I always hate listening to podcasts and it's
oh my gosh,
you can obviously tell they didn't read the book and like they're asking the dumbest questions possible. You know,
it's so painful. I'm like, oh, okay. So you use the media kit that IVP has up. Cool.
Perfect.
Yeah. I've answered these same questions.
Yeah. Right. Okay. So let's have you introduce the book maybe to everybody and then kind of a why behind some of this.
All right. So the thesis behind the book is that contemporary society is not built for humans as God designed us, that our environment is not fit for us. And the reason for that is that our society is designed with a certain conception of what it means to be human. All societies have to be designed with a conception of what it means to live a human life and who humans are. So if you begin with a false anthropology, you're going to create an environment that is toxic or harmful or contrary to, antagonistic towards people. And in the book, I liken this to, animals in the zoo, which will experience something called zoocosis when they're meant to be out in the wild, but we put them in cages. And even though we design those cages with the best zoology knowledge that we have to make them fit, it's never the same. And so you'll see animals sometimes pacing in circles endlessly because they are mentally ill, because this is not an environment made for them. So my theory is that our contemporary society assumes that we are fundamentally our own and belong to ourselves. Now, that includes the idea of individualism that often gets talked about. But I didn't go with the term individualism because I think so often it has connotations with being contrary to collectivism, and there's this political dimension, and this can include what I'm talking about, can include that, but it's also deeper. It's more experiential. Like, it's not just individualism in the sense that I'm going to do my own thing. It's also how you exist in the world is fundamentally in belonging to yourself. All right. So if that's what we're taught, but we're not, then we should expect to feel terrible. And I think that is the case. And so what inspired this book was in fact, a number of different incidences. So I can think of three. So one is when I did my first book, Disruptive Witness, you know, it was about technology and distractions and our, and secularism. And a lot of times I'd have people ask me like, okay, so what's your practice to turn off technology or get away from it? And what they really wanted was a checklist or a method to get away from distractions. And what I found myself thinking was, okay, but when I'm at work all day and I come home and my kids are crazy and I barely get them to sleep at 8:30 or 9 o'clock, very often all my wife and I can do is turn on a good sitcom, like, you know, a really funny one. And that feels sometimes like distraction, but it also feels different. And so what I discovered was, in my book, I primarily talked about all these methods of distraction as ways of avoiding questions of sin and God's existence and our mortality and things like that. And I came to discover in talking with people who kept asking me for these things, and I would check my own heart and be like, that's not why I'm doing this. Mm. Like, so there's something else going on too. And what I think that is I think that we live in an environment that requires us to have coping mechanisms to get through the day. Yeah. So that was the first thing. The second thing was for quite a while, my wife was, she has two master's degrees, one in economics and one in math. And she had a very difficult time finding a job here in Shawnee, Oklahoma. There's not a lot of advanced you know, for data, big data in Oklahoma or in Shawnee, Oklahoma. And so she was staying home with our kids for a while and just experiencing that vicariously. I saw these just painful dynamics. So one, I realized, and I experienced this a little bit staying home with my kids two summers ago, when you're home with kids in a modern city, you're often cut off from all other adults because we don't live in communities anymore. Right. We just don't. And so you're just around little kids all day. And that's fine. And kids are wonderful. That's fine for a couple of days. But if it's a prolonged period of time, like, it's very clear, like, this is not healthy. We're not meant to be so isolated, to be raising kids alone. So there was that dynamic. Another dynamic was whenever she would meet someone new, they would ask her, so what do you do? And if she said, well, I'm a stay-at-home mom, maybe they're nice and they say something positive. That's really great. But then they're like, so what does your husband do? And so there's this sense like, I support your choice,
right,
but really you're boring. Like, your life is sort of meaningless. You're not doing anything. Your life is on pause. And my wife knew that that's a lie, that society says, which is that you have to have a career to be meaningful. But she still experienced that dehumanization. And so I was thinking, okay, so the way we have families, the way, you know, that we raise children, this seems to be fundamentally disordered. Mm. And so the third thing is experiencing, especially my college seniors who are raised in Christian homes and should have a good sense of their identity and what it means to live a good life. And they get to the end of their college career and they have an existential crisis. And they're feeling like, if I don't pick the right career, if I don't marry the right person, my life is meaningless. Yeah. And everything is riding on this next job. And so I was thinking, okay, yeah, you know what? If we are our own and we belong to ourselves, that's true. Like, you're the only one who can make your life meaningful, so you better get it right. But that's not true. And Christians should know that, but we don't. Why don't we? Well, because all of society is telling us, no, it really is up to you, so get it right. So all those kinds of things were going through my mind and weighing on me very heavily. Mm-hmm. And so I wanted to write, I guess, you know, even for my own sake, an explanation. Why is it that we're so disordered as a society? And that's this book.
Yeah, it's great. I really appreciated it. There was a lot there. I think talking about kids, so I'm a pastor, but I stay at home almost full time while my wife works away from the home. And being a stay-at-home mom can be very hard. Being a stay-at-home dad, though, is a whole different deal, you know?
Yeah.
You feel like the creepy dude at the park, you know what I mean?
Yes, yes.
Yeah. So, and we had a whole year of COVID where my kids were homeschooled all year. And so, you know, I just like, I really resonated with that, you know, and then the ways that we're like so isolated, right? I mean, you live in the burbs and that's what you do. You're just, isolated people.
Yeah. So I had that experience 2 summers ago. My wife got a job and because I teach college, so I was off, the kids were off and I was at home and it was mentally, it was very bad for me. And, yeah, so you feel like the creepy dude, but also you just feel cut off. So I found myself on social media more, and what I was reminding myself was like, okay, what exactly are you doing? Are you distracting yourself, or is this just the best way that you can have adult interactions?
Right.
And that's what I realized. Like, this is a coping mechanism. It's a technique that I can use. It's not ideal. In the ideal world, I would be raising kids like in an extended family, in close communities. We'd be hanging out. There wouldn't be a pandemic, all these sorts of things. But I don't have control over that. Right. So what can I do? And so I found myself on social media more than I would like to be. And this is, again, this is part of it, is that sometimes I think we beat ourselves up. We don't have grace for each other or ourselves. Like, oh, I'm on Instagram too much. Well, you know what? Like, if you don't have an adult conversation all day long for months on end, like, I don't know, maybe commenting on your friend's Instagram post is not really that bad. Like, maybe that's what we need to do, because we have to accept, I can't totally change society, but I need to get through the day. And that's another thing, is I kept thinking about this phrase, I just need to get through today, or I just need to do this. And I feel like that's a mantra I hear a lot of adults saying, I just got to get through this. I just got to get through this. I'm like, man, we're just dragging ourselves through life.
You're right. And I think, okay, so you captured me at the very beginning of the book talking about belonging, because I don't think I'd ever really thought about belonging to others. But you even talk about in a marital relationship, right? Like, you might be subject to your spouse and like you belong to them, but even like your fantasy life can be outside of that belonging, you know, much less all these other things. And so I had never sort of conceptualized what even belonging truly was, I guess.
Yeah. Yeah. I wrote, are you thinking about the sections where I talked about pornography a lot?
Yeah, I think it was sort of like stacked all in all of that.
I
do.
Yeah, I touch on it in a few different places. Yeah, I mean, as I thought through this, one of the chapters basically begins with a long section on pornography and the way it's a coping mechanism, and the way it can be a coping mechanism, I think, in marriages in a very unhealthy way. Because, you know, the thing about intimacy is that it requires vulnerability, and you know, and that makes sense if you belong to someone else.
Right.
But it's also very risky. It's also very risky, and it takes a lot of time. It takes a lot of emotional energy, physical energy, spiritual energy, and frankly, if you're burnt out, and a lot of contemporary people feel burnt out, then pornography is a coping mechanism that doesn't require you to be vulnerable at all. It doesn't require you to belong to your spouse intimately, and can quote unquote fulfill, or at least give, you know, some help you cope with these sexual desires that you have. But of course, it's destructive. And it always, one of the things that I discovered is that a lot of these coping mechanisms end up leading to addiction in one form or another. There's feelings of inadequacy. The feelings of inadequacy lead to addiction and depression. And that, you know, that's often a path that people go down when they participate in pornography.
Yeah. Let's set up the problem. Cause I feel like the first half of the book, you set up the problem that we're involved in, which involves the sort of philosophy of our day. Right. And you talk about a lot, and I don't think we could even like scratch the surface, but can you just introduce sort of what you see as sort of the anthropology, of today?
Sure. So, and I don't have a historical account of exactly how this developed. I have a pretty good idea, but I don't give that account because I think that's for other scholars to do. And this isn't a scholarly book, and that kind of thing is kind of dull. But I think that through big ideas in academia, but also through material things like the way markets work and the way our cities are laid out. So this is not a somebody had a really a disturbing idea and then it trickled down and corrupted all of society.
Yeah.
I think that's an aspect of it, but it's also just how we structure things that affects it. So I think that's important to understand. But I think what happens is that in our laws, in our values, in our practices, in our habits, in all of these areas, we assume we are our own. And so that has a few different ramifications. So the first one I talk about, I believe, is justification. And so you have this idea taught all over the place that your life is fundamentally your own and you've got to make it worthwhile. You have to make it interesting. You have to, sometimes we talk about it as telling a good story. You got to make sure you're the protagonist in your story. You got to tell a good story. It could be that you've got to achieve certain things. You have to, you know, be successful. You've got to be fulfilled. You've got to live life to the fullest. All this language that fundamentally means that there are all different ways of saying that your life is worth living. Mm. You've justified your life. Your existence is worth being there. And so that creates this tremendous pressure. And this is one of the reasons why my students will feel overwhelmed, because they're like, man, if everything's riding on this next step, how do I even start? Especially because there are more and more options available to them. And that has to happen. So if you live in a society that says, okay, you're the only one who can make your life worthwhile, well, that society has to provide you with lots of different options, lots of different ways to do that. And that's exactly what our society does. The problem is the more options you have in anything, the more likely you are to fall into choice paralysis and the less likely you are to be content.
Right.
And so this is what happens, is that often, you know, we feel like I'm just going to curl up in the fetal position. I don't know what job to choose. I don't know where to move. I don't know what to do. I don't know who I should be. So there's justification. I think also identity. Obviously, there's this sense in which our identity is tenuous, right? So like you're just being alive and being human doesn't mean you have an identity in the contemporary world. Like you got to earn it. You got to go out there and hustle and make yourself someone, make a name for yourself, make an identity, a brand. And you've got to look inside yourself sometimes to discover what that is, or look outside and find something that pleases you. But there's always this quest to create and put together an identity. The problem is that it's never... it's never static. It's always shifting. It's always moving underneath you. So you always feel like, man, I don't know who I am enough. And so you get people who are constantly expressing their identity on social media, for example, because they just need to do it more and more and more and more in order to feel like, okay, I know who I am. Mm. So I talk about identity. I talk about, meaning, right? Because I think meaning making. So how do we know that something means something? How do I know that love is actually a thing rather than just something that I experience in my mind? I'm missing one, values. Yes, I talk about values. Okay, where do we get values from if we are our own? Right. How do we establish values? And then finally, I talk about belonging in general, right? Because everybody needs to feel like they belong somewhere. So how do you know where you belong if you fundamentally belong to yourself?
Yeah.
And so society creates all these different challenges and gives us tools to try to meet these obligations, but these what I call responsibilities of self-belonging. But what I argue is that the tools that society gives us to meet these responsibilities, like giving us lots of job options, for example, actually don't solve the problem. They actually make it worse, and then we feel terrible, and then they give us other coping mechanisms. So that's still very broad. You're right. It's a tough book to talk about, honestly.
It is. There's a lot like, there.
I bit off too much. I don't know. I'm glad you got through the first half, because the first half is pretty, you know, grim.
You know, there is some of that. But I think we need to know, because it's the water we swim in, right? Like we can't see these things for ourselves that we have actually developed this mindset of self-belonging, right? Another aspect of that you talk about, and I love Jacques Ellul, and you talk about his book, Technological Society, right? I think it's brilliant. I mean, he was so far ahead of his time in all of this stuff. It's crazy. So can you just talk about efficiency as like the greatest good of our day, and then how that plays out into our lives?
Yes. Yeah, so if we are our own, what does this mean about values? Well, it means that there are no values that we can necessarily accept. So we can all have our own values. And I think the exception to that is efficiency, because efficiency has to do with measurement. Now, we might not agree on measurements exactly, but that's something that we can negotiate. We can talk about. If I say that this action is immoral and you say, well, I don't think it's immoral, we come to a standstill. But if I say this action leads to this measurable harm and this percentage of people have been harmed by this activity, now we can have our society has a conversation. And sure enough, if you look at our public discourse, it is heavily reliant upon measurable harm and therefore really efficiency. Like, is this policy inefficient because it's causing people measurable harm? So the conclusion I come to is that I do think efficiency becomes, you know, the one value that we can really agree upon. But the problem with efficiency is that it's not a human value. It's a good thing. Efficiency is a good thing. But as Christians, we've got to say, okay, it has to be subservient to love of God and love of neighbor. And sometimes loving your neighbor means being inefficient. It means inviting them over to your house and feeding them food and talking to them, even though you're not going to get ahead in your career, even though it's not going to make your neighborhood better. You know, there's no tangible, measurable benefit to it, but it's good. And so you do it anyway. So one of the things I note is that in many different areas in our society, we stress efficiency. And as a result, we get these inhuman results, because what happens is, and Alul argues that the reign of efficiency, of what he calls technique, which really comes down to efficiency, is that it pushes all those other values out. So religious values, I'm sorry, you can't get in the way of efficiency. We have to be efficient. And I think that's one major source of dehumanization. So one example I've been dealing with, we just made a trip to California. I don't know about if you heard about this, but I've been complaining about it on social media.
Yes, the van.
Driving home. We get to Flagstaff, or almost to Flagstaff. A mountain lion jumps in front of us, totals our van. It was insane. Airbags go off. And so I've spent a lot of time on the phone with insurance, auto body shops, just trying to sort everything out. And I've experienced a lot of call waiting. And to me, this is a perfect example. So if you're a business and you're thinking, okay, what are the most important values? Well, if efficiency is an important value, then it makes total sense to keep someone like me on the line. So that night, it was 10 o'clock at night. We hit a mountain lion. It's dark. There's woods right by us. We know there are mountain lions there because we hit one, right? I've got three small kids. They're freaked out. We're all like traumatized in a minor way. And I'm like, I got to get us out of here. I got it. So I'm on the phone trying to get a tow truck, and I'm sitting there, and it was a computer, right? And so the computer was trying to, because you can't just call and immediately get a person, that you got to go through all these. And so they're like, if you would like to do this, say this. And I'm like, I was screaming some profanities on the side of the road. Just let me talk to a blinking human. And it felt so dehumanizing. It was like, I'm in this terrible situation. I'm scared for the life of my family. If somebody clips this van, we could die. And I'm getting a robot. Now, why do they feel like this is acceptable? Well, you know, if efficiency is the most important value, then it makes total sense. But if there's something more important than efficiency, like human life or, you know, human dignity, then you would say, huh, if we have an emergency phone line for people who, you know, need tows, we should probably have a human picking up the phone. It's going to cost us more, but we should probably do that.
Yeah.
I think people need to talk to a human.
Yeah. Like the value of humanity. It's like, yeah.
Yeah.
This is going to maybe sound weird and like a strange segue, but as I was sort of talking or reading through your book, I'm teaching through Revelation right now, and so everything sort of like goes through that, you know, like paradigm
lens
for me.
Okay,
you know.
Yeah.
And so I was just thinking about sort of the God of this world, like how the Satan sort of ruling over this world, as we know from Ephesians, and how the it's so like this mentality is so dehumanizing, but just worms its way into even the church, so that we all operate in this way, even though we don't know it. And that's like this, that's what we're called to be, countercultural, right? Like to push back against like not caring for humans and whatnot. And so I just saw that first part of the book just working its way out and showing us like how far we've fallen from like a biblical ethic.
Yeah. And that's such an important point that it's wormed its way into the church, because this book, and I say in the introduction, this is that I wrote it as an insider, not as, because there are many books where it's like, hey, I figured out what all your problems are. and that's fine. You know, if you're a guru, if you're an expert, you know, you do that. But these are things that I've acutely experienced myself. Like I've experienced these things, my own failings. Sometimes I've seen this happen in the church. I see this happen in so many of my students. And I'm not presenting this as like, here's this secular ideology that's snuck in and polluted. It's insidious. But it is insidious and it is secular. But it's not just an ideology. It's in our practices. It's in our habits. And as you said, it's like the air we breathe. And so we feel like this is not part of us, but it so is. And so I hope to write a book I wanted to write something that didn't chastise and didn't condemn, but instead say, does this resonate? Like, do you feel this? Because if you do, let's figure out where this is coming from. And we need to start pushing back, because I think it's in our house. I think it's deeply rooted in our own homes, and we need to do something.
Yeah. And I think that's why I resonated. I'm in this geriatric millennial sort of category of life, right?
Same. Yeah.
So, but I feel like I know this happened in the generation before us, but I feel like we were the first ones to really start experiencing this. And now as we like reach our late 30s, early 40s sort of deal, we're like experiencing all of these things coming down at once. And not only that, we're watching our kids walk through the same things as we did that sort of like made this happen. I'm watching my kids in school, and this meritocracy you talk about of like having to like, you know, be the best in your class and like succeed, achieve academically is like absolutely killing me. You know, like I can't even handle it. And so I think we're just seeing all this stuff sort of come to fruition, and it's getting real, I guess, for me now, which is why the book resonated so much.
Yeah, I think that's such an important point. The meritocracy, and some students, as I talk about in the book, you know, some young people will buy in. And I've certainly had many of those students. I think I was that person, like, okay, there's a way to be successful beating everybody else. All right, I'm just going to put my head down and I'm going to do that. The problem, but the other response is what I call resignation, where you look at it and you're like, wait, this meritocracy is nonsense. Like, it doesn't actually work. It's not actually just or fair. I can't actually beat them. Like, I'm not as smart, or I'm not as fit, or I'm not, you know, whatever. Yeah. I'm not born wealthy. I'm not going to win. I'm not going to be able to compete. So why don't I just distract myself? And so one of the things I tried to do with this book too is, you know, there has been, it's trickling off a little bit, but there has been for the last decade or so, a lot of criticism about younger people playing too many video games or binge watching TV, or just the sense that they're lazy. They don't want to leave their parents' homes. And when I interact with students, and some of those students are those students. So I've had students who are like, okay, what, I didn't turn in my paper, Dr. Noble, because I just watched Friends the entire weekend. Right. And when they say that, they're not like, screw you. Like, I had a lot of fun watching Friends. Like, they're depressed. Yeah. They feel terrible. Like, they don't want to scroll through TikTok for 24 hours. Like, that's a kind of hell. So why are they doing this? Well, they feel despair. And so they're thinking, what can I do to kind of numb myself? And so in my opinion, there's this big misconception that a lot of younger people are just lazy and they don't care. They've never had to work for things. And I'm like, no. It's that they believe they have to work so hard that they can't make it.
Yeah.
And so they've said, screw all this. I'm tapping out. Like, if this is the game and I can never compete, I'm not playing your dumb game. I'm done. I'll just give up. And it's an interesting time to live, because you can live a pretty comfortable, entertained, pleasurable life without having to do much.
Yeah.
That hasn't been, you know, historically, you know, you'd starve to death. And so there are space for people to do that.
Yeah. It is. And the, like, even you talk about the meritocracy that we supposedly all live in, it's all about connections. And I, as I've gotten older, I've realized that more and more, like, it's more about who you know than it is anything else, any sort of merit, like any of these people on these big stages doing whatever, fulfilling their dreams on Instagram or whatever, like that, a lot of that's just luck. Right.
Yes.
And like, so we don't, so even if you do strive and you do all the things and you believe in a meritocracy, it still might not amount to anything.
Yeah.
And we live our lives like that, you know?
And so if the way you feel justification, if the way you conceive of your life having meaning and purpose and value is through those achievements, then at that point you're screwed.
Yeah.
Right. Because you realize I can't compete. So because I don't have those connections, so I'm done. But if that's not the case, then you can say like, cool. So like they have this successful thing. All right, good for them. Like that doesn't mean anything at all about me.
Yeah.
So, but when you see that the meritocracy isn't real, it's a relief. So as a writer, as somebody who's edited a lot of writers at Christ and Pop Culture, I've discovered that there are a lot of people who are much smarter than me, who are better writers, who have better ideas, who will never be published. Mm. And why will they never be published? Sometimes it's connections. Sometimes, like their life circumstances, they just don't have the time to sit down and write. Sometimes it's education, all kinds of different things, right? Sometimes it's insecurity. But there are people who should be published before I was ever published.
Yeah.
That's a fact. And their book should be much more successful than anything I've written. The opposite is also true. There are a lot of people who should not be writing anything, who write terrible, toxic books that are eating at our culture, who sell obscene amounts of books. And so what you have to sit back and realize is, and I think this is not just true with writing, but it's helped me with writing. It's a humbling thing because you realize, okay, why am I doing this? Well, I'm not doing this because I'm the best. I'm not doing this because I'm the most fit for this, that I've earned it, or I'm the one who should be doing this. For whatever reason, God's put me in this situation, and so my duty is just to do this to His glory, and whatever happens, happens. But I need to know that it's not because I'm great, because there are much better people, and there are much worse people involved, you know, who are much more successful. So once you come to that realization that this meritocracy doesn't actually work, it's not true, you can just shove that aside and say, what matters is, what is the work God has put before me today? I'm going to do that and try to do that with excellence. And that's a relief. It's a relief.
Yeah. And that's like, I mean, that's the podcast in a lot of ways is like a true theology of work, right? Where it's not about a success and it's not about the things that, you know, it's about God's kingdom here and now and in front of me, you know? And I think that's such a powerful thing. And I think you have your finger on the pulse of a lot of what's going on in our culture and a lot of this stuff just sort of behind the scenes, like making us feel depressed and, you know, leading us to these, you know, coping skills, coping mechanisms that you talk about and these diseases of despair, you know?
Yeah.
I really appreciated that. So guide us then into what does it mean to belong to God? And I love that there's not a four-step process here, right? But I would love to know your thoughts just on the other side of this thing.
Yeah. So it's, this is the biggest challenge in writing. So there are two challenges. One is that the problem is so big. How do you even describe it? And the second problem is that I'm making the argument that the problem is so deeply rooted. It's in the structures of our society. And I don't think that we can just uproot them and change things for the better. So like, what do you tell people? Like, we're screwed. Sorry, guys. Everything's terrible. But at least you know why it's terrible. Isn't that nice? But that's not where I leave. Right. Yeah. So there are sort of two major things that I think that we do when we understand our proper anthropology, that we are not our own but belong to Christ. First, all those categories I talked about before, justification, identity, meaning, value, and belonging, are properly ordered. And we no longer are faced with this inhuman burden to try to bear these responsibilities on our own. That's no longer a thing. So for example, with identity, you have an identity because there is a being outside of you who knows your name and knows your face, period.
Amen.
That's it. Yeah. That's it. Like, you don't need to build anything. Yeah. So the first thing I think we have to do is that we see rightly. So we see the lies that are being taught. We recognize that we're in an environment that's not made for us. Okay. And then we understand our true anthropology, belonging to God. And that does equip us to push back. That does equip us to say, you know, like that scenario where my wife meets someone new, you know, when she was staying at home, and they're like, what do you do? And if you say nothing, she feels dehumanized. It does give her more agency to push back and be like, oh, I know why I'm feeling that, because society tells me that I have to have a career to be important. Right. Okay, that's a lie. And that gives you agency to push back on that. But people are still going to treat you that way. So that's the flip side, is that you making this internal recognition. I don't want this to be like the idea that, well, if it's just a mindset thing, you know, this mindset is so important on Instagram. I'm endlessly fascinated with people who are talking about mindset change. You just have to have the right mindset. Okay. If you have the right mindset, society will still treat you the way it's treating you. So it's not going to change that. So the second thing is, we have spheres of influence, and where those spheres of influence are, we need to act to create a more human society, an environment that is more aligned with Christ, how Christ has made us. Now, when I say that, I'm not giving, as you say, a 4-point plan, like, here's how we change society. In fact, where I come down, and I'm getting this from just entirely from Jacques Ellul, is that we have to say, we can't change Nineveh, but God can save an entire city. And that's miraculous. Yeah. And that's who we're relying on. So I argue, don't come up with a 5-point plan to change all of society, but work faithfully and display God where you are and have your hope in him. And if he chooses to radically save our society, he can do that. But you can't do that. That's the thing, is that you can't. And when we put that burden on our shoulders, we're back to square one, I feel.
Yeah, it's just just so devotional. I mean, I don't know. Maybe I should be vulnerable here or something. But just like, even this concept.
Be vulnerable.
I try once in a while, you know. This concept that the love of God is just like sort of overwhelming, you know, and like really hard to sort of wrap your mind around. Even this idea of belonging to God, that God would care so much for his creation that he would that he would love us. And like that, even that love is so hard to even comprehend for me. And so I find that maybe I get lost. I always say it's like really easy for me to tell other people that God loves him. It's a lot harder for me to tell myself that God loves me, you know?
Yeah. No, I mean, that's why I think we need regular worship, because we have liturgies that are created to remind us of that. Because doctrinally, I'm all there, right? It's total, it makes total sense. No objections at all. But experientially, right? Do I feel God's love? Do I know that he loves me? That's difficult. That's hard. Do I know that my identity, is before God? It's not something that I have to work up to have an identity that's meaningful. Not most of the time. Most of the time, society's whisperings that I have to announce who I am are louder. But we're moving through this. Jacques Ellul talks a lot about the city. The modern world is a kind of city that is bent on its fundamental nature, is it's trying to exist autonomously from God. And when you're in the city, these are the kinds of things that are going to happen. And so we need each other. We need regular worship. We need to be reminded. And, you know, you need to remind people, right? And other people need to remind you that God loves you. And that means specific things, that it's not just this airy statement, but it has concrete real world implications to who you are, where you belong. And so, but it's not easy. It's not easy. Yeah. This is going to be one of the tough sells of the book, is that I'm like, life's still really hard.
Yeah.
Society's going to still be screwed up, but we have obligations. We have to push back.
Yeah. But it's so simple at the same time, right? Just find your identity in Christ, right? I mean,
yeah.
And like, I guess that's so simple and so it feels cliche or something, but it is so deeply formative to who we are. And the longer we try to like establish our own identity, like you point out in the book, which I thought was brilliant, the more lost we're going to, like, the autonomy leads to being lost rather than being found, right?
Yes. And so I try to use language of belonging before God, because I think that idea of God witnessing our existence, like God can see us and he can see our face and he knows our name. Therefore, there's someone in existence before whom we always stand, who knows us absolutely. So our identity, it will feel fluid. It'll feel like we don't know who we are, but we are known, period.
Yeah.
And that's helpful. Sometimes I think with the identity, you know, you talked about it, this is a potentially as a cliche. And I think, you know, finding your identity in Christ, it has become a cliche. And how you define that really matters, right? Because sometimes I feel like when people say that, they really mean, I need to lose my personality and become more like evangelically, you know, like I need to, you know, like adopt these preferences that fit this certain subculture because that's having my identity in Christ. And it's like, but that's, you know, okay. I'm in union with Christ. But I still have tastes. I still have preferences. I still have interests. I still have, you know, quirks of my personality that, you know, Jesus was not known for his puns. I really love puns. It's a good thing that I have. That's just one of the things I like doing. Okay.
Right.
So, you know, sometimes when people talk about having their identity in Christ, it feels like they're being absorbed, right? Like, so they lose their personhood. And that's not exactly what union with Christ means. So I think, so I try to think about living before God, and this, which I'm getting from Kierkegaard. And, I find that to be helpful.
Yeah, I think that's good. I think it's, I mean, and you talk about the catechism, right? And, how some of that, I mean, some of that stuff that we've lost as evangelicals, if I can still call, like, you know, say that word and know what I mean.
Yeah.
But, you know, some of that stuff that we've lost, right, has profound impacts in even our formation and that. So,
yeah. Yeah. So I use the Heidelberg Catechism first question and answer, which I find super fascinating because it begins with the question, what is your only comfort in life and death? And I mentioned this in the book, but I just love that it begins with this existential dread, right? Like, like both your life and your death is frightening and you need some kind of comfort. And I just love that. Like that's the first question in the catechism is like, hey, listen, you probably need comfort in life because life is really hard and death is terrifying. So here's what it is. And just the fact that it, you know, it doesn't begin, I mean, the gospel is in that, but it doesn't begin with the traditional way we think of the gospel where, you know, something like, do you know you're a sinner and what do you do with that sin? No, it begins with your experience of being in the world, which is, at times filled with a lot of suffering.
Yeah.
And, that idea is absolutely still true today. And I think it does have a lot to tell us.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
That's good. That's good. Well, Alan, I really love the book. If you couldn't tell, I was nerding out, but I found it sort of, it's really been resonating with me, to be honest with you. And I just want to encourage you in that good. Like, you know, I'm a pastor. I've been doing this a long time. I teach other people about stuff. And this thing's just been like ruminating with me, and it's increased my prayer life significantly. So
that's really good to hear. Cause, I haven't heard, I not very many people have read it or told me what they thought about it yet. And so when you work this, it was years I've been working on this project and I'm like, I don't know what I made. I really have no idea. I wrote a book. I know I wrote it. I don't know if it's any good. I don't know if it got communicated. So that's really encouraging. So thank you.
It is. Yeah. Okay. So Alan, where are the best places to sort of find you, find out about the book, all your brilliant ideas on life and all that stuff?
So oalannoble.com is my website, and that'll connect you to various social media accounts and also to, you know, where you can pre-order the book. On Twitter, I'm the Alan Noble, I think. I'm pretty sure. Probably the same thing on Instagram. I don't know.
Sounds right.
That sounds highly likely. It sounds like something. Let's see. No, it's O Alan Noble on Instagram. O Alan Noble on Instagram. That's confusing. That's unfortunate.
It happens to us all, right?
It's inefficient.
Yeah.
It's good. but there it is. So, yeah. So, yeah. Pre-order the book and read it, and then let me know what you think, people, because I'm dying to know.
I love it. Okay. I always like to end up with two final questions. Are you okay jumping into those?
Yes. I don't remember them, so you're going to have to ask me.
That's fine. They're easy. Okay. Good. So my first question is, what is the strangest job that you have ever had?
I was a an English tutor at a probation camp for high school felons.
Yes.
Yeah.
That's
so
awesome.
So, and this is in Southern California. So working with a lot of very young, early gang members, you know, they were, you know, mostly in because of dads and uncles and brothers and things.
Yeah.
And, I learned a lot, and, I learned a lot about the way people try to justify their lives. One quick fascinating story. One of the things I discovered is that a lot of the students who would be in for sometimes some horrific crimes, not violent, but they had often done a lot of horrific crimes that just didn't get caught for it. But they would love to talk about God, and they would love to pray. But one of the mantras I heard was that them praying that God would help them get out, but they really didn't want to get out. Like it was almost like the narrative of them being stuck was a part of the drama and romance of their lives. And I realized this is part of the way that they justify their lives is that they think they see themselves as trapped in this. And some of them, you know, there are certain material conditions that made it very difficult, but often they would pray something like, dear God, forgive me, or help my mom forgive me because I can't get out. And I'm like, but okay. If you know that your mom would not want you to be in this gang, maybe instead of praying that she would forgive you, you could get out. So anyway, so that was interesting. That was a very interesting job. I learned a lot, and it was, it was good.
Yeah. That's a culture shock. My wife is a social worker, and she has a heart for juvenile justice. She worked in there, a lot of years. And so, it is a whole world. So
yeah,
it's good. I loved that I saw that in your bio, and I was like, yeah, I love that. I think that's cool. So
yeah, it's good stuff. That was cool.
Okay. So my final question is, what is one piece of advice you would give to somebody looking to bring God's kingdom more into their work?
So the number one thing I would say is consider how your work is for the good of others, right? And this is one of the implications at the end of the book, is that if we belong to God, we also belong to his church, and then we also belong to our families, and in a similar, not identical way, we also belong to our communities and to creation. So that means that when we work, we can't take this secular perspective, which is so common, where we think, I am just going to go, I'm going to do my job and get paid, and whatever work I'm doing, like, I'm not responsible for its implications. Like, I'm not responsible if it destroys the creation or hurts my neighbors or if this is toxic or if, like, the entire essence of this business is premised on making people covetous and so they spend money and get into debt and then their lives spiral out of control. Like, I'm not responsible for that. They're adults. I am my own, right? But, okay, if that's not true, if we belong to God, then we have to ask those questions. Mm-hmm. And I honestly think that there are occupations that Christians will, have today that maybe they really shouldn't. And so we're comfortable saying that with a few things, like, okay, you shouldn't be in pornography. All right. Okay. Done. All right. You shouldn't be in organized crime. All right. Well, that's easy. Shouldn't be a hitman. Okay. But what if your whole job in advertising is to lie to people to get them to buy stuff that is bad for their souls and bad for their bodies and bad for creation and bad for, their bank account, because it's getting them into debt for nothingness, right? Like, and I think that there are probably a lot of things like that. And so the first step is asking yourself, okay, is this work loving to my neighbor? Is this honoring to my neighbor? Is this helping their dignity? Or is this just me focusing on me and paying my bills? And I think that's a difficult, a hard question to ask, and one we do not want to ask, but I think we have to.
Yeah. Yeah, I think you're right, and I think that's important and ethically. that's a lot of prayer, and that's a lot of listening to the Holy Spirit, right?
Yeah.
And I think the intentionality behind it is something we often just don't have, you know, even thinking through those things. Alan, that's awesome, man. Thanks for the book. Thanks for the work, and thanks for making time for me.
Hey, thanks for reading this and for encouraging me and having me on. It's been a really good time.
That's awesome.
Thank you.
Thanks. Well, I hope you enjoyed hearing from Alan. I just highly encourage you again to go check out this book. It's awesome. You can pre-order it right now. You are going to thank me later. I will guarantee that. And just check out what Alan's got going on. It's just great stuff. That was a great time to go to the bottom of your iTunes app. You can leave a rating and review there just to help get the word out about the podcast. I always greatly appreciate you just taking time to do that stuff and just even letting me know that you're listening. I think it's super helpful. I greatly appreciate that. And until next time, get out there and hustle.